the folks that have been around for several years, I'm sure, remember our speaker tonight. I just refer to him as Mr. Shenandoah Valley. I mean, that's how I know him. So anyway, without further ado, let me do an intro for him. What are you doing? Can you leave it there?
Jim.
Caroline's parents are here.
Oh, fantastic. Did you see the newspaper?
Yes, we have.
Okay. Oh, fantastic. So Carolyn, our scholarship winners, mother and father are here tonight.
Finding neighbors keep giving. Obviously, you did great advertising.
Thank you. Could you email Turbovich that? Because I'm the media guy. Hey, that's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. Again, most everybody here will recognize who I'm going to be introducing here in just a second. The title of tonight's lecture is Phil Sheridan, Drew Worley, and the Last Battle of Winchester, i.e. Winchester 3. Tonight's talk will focus on Sheridan's assignment to command and the strategy that he developed, working closely with Lieutenant General U.S. Grant, while ensuring that the election political considerations of Abraham Lincoln's administration were adhered to. Likewise, we will examine the expectation that Lee had for Early and how Early met both of them, as well as Early's performance as a battle leader at Winchester. There will also be a comparison of the two generals' backgrounds and combat experience prior to Winchester. September 19th, isn't this great?
Yeah.
We're darn close to it. 1864 showdown between these two commanders was the largest battle ever fought in the valley, by all measures, and resulted in more than 9,000 casualties. Scott Patchen is a native of Cleveland, Ohio, and we'll excuse you for that. But no, you got LeBron now, so they're going to be coming up. And everybody else that's going there. And he's lived most of his life in Virginia, a lifelong student of military history. Scott became enthralled with the 1864 Valley Campaign while attending JMU, James Madison, in Harrisonburg in the 1980s. He's written 5 books on the Civil War and dozens of articles for various publications, including 6 articles for the Blue and Gray magazine called The General's Tours. He's also served as a historical consultant and writer for Time Life Books, Voices of the Civil War, Shenandoah 1864 volume. He is currently on the board of the Kernstown Battlefield Association and has twice served as president of Bull Run Civil War Roundtable. His most recent book was The Last Battle of Winchester, and he is currently researching and preparing for his next volume on the 1864 Shenandoah Valley Campaign. Please join me in welcoming back Scott Patchen.
No, I usually, I'll stand back to hear me without the microphone. Well, after 21 years, I guess you've run out of topics. Because, I don't know, any there 21 years and 8 days ago, I gave a talk, the first talk I ever gave on a Civil War topic to the Bull Run Civil War Roundtable back at Manassas Battlefield when we used to meet there. So, it's seems like yesterday, but it's a long time ago, so it's good to be back here. I'm probably going to pull back on some of that. I have a time limitation. I have to be somewhere at 9 o'clock to pick up my daughter, but I want to make sure I give you enough time to answer questions, because I know that questions at roundtables are really, really what you get into. Now, the 1864 Shenandoah Valley Campaign is different than any of the Valley campaigns that come before it. And that is due to one single factor, and that is the appointment by President Abraham Lincoln of Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant to be the Supreme Commander of the United States Armies. Grant realized, looking on what had happened during the first 3 years of the war, that the Confederacy had utilized interior lines of communication to move troops to threatened sectors when Union forces in one area were not operating, were in a dormant state of, you know, not conducting active campaigns. And he decided that he was going to have simultaneous offensives across all of the states that were in rebellion. He would have Sherman going against Joe Johnston in the Atlanta campaign. In the far west, he had hoped that Nathaniel Banks' army would have been making a campaign for Mobile, Alabama, but before he could stop him, Banks was already on his ill-fated Red River campaign. But at least he was moving and tying down Confederate forces. In Virginia, he had a multi-pronged there. Obviously, we're all extremely familiar with Lee versus Grant during the Overland campaign. We also had Benjamin Beast Butler moving against Beauregard up the James River. But out in western Virginia, which is going to lead into what my area that I like to talk about in the Shenandoah Valley, was originally a three-pronged campaign. The commander of that department was Major General Franz Sigel, and Sigel was going to lead an army south out of Martinsburg. George Crook was going to lead forces out of southern West Virginia deep into the heart of southwest Virginia to destroy railroads and salt and lead mines. General Ord was supposed to lead forces over from central West Virginia to Stanton, and they were all supposed to link up in the valley and then head east to Lynchburg, a vital Confederate supply center. Well, Ord got so frustrated dealing with the incompetent and bungling Sigel that he bagged out of that months before the campaign began, and it ends up being a two-pronged attack. Grant, you know, they knew that Franz Sigel was a known quantity in command, and they thought, at least Grant reasoned, he understood the political realities. 1864 is a presidential election year, and, you know, there was nothing new about ethnic group politics even in that day. The German vote was quite important to Abraham Lincoln, and so we had to have the darling of the German community, Franz Sigel, in somewhat of a prominent role. Grant took the approach, he said, well, at least Sigel could hold a leg while the rest of us do the skinning. Unfortunately, he erred. The leg kicked Sigel in the rear end, and he was defeated at the Battle of Newmarket on May 15th. Crook is successful in southwest Virginia, doesn't hear any messages or anything, so he turns around back into West Virginia and back where we start. Robert E. Lee, for his part, after the Battle of Newmarket, wants to continue the tradition of Stonewall Jackson, going on the offensive, following up those defeated Federals in the Shenandoah Valley. John Breckinridge was capable enough to defeat Franz Sigel at Newmarket, but he didn't like that idea too much, and we don't have his reply when Lee tells him to head north towards the Potomac in Maryland, but we do have Lee replying to Breckinridge a second time about the next day, stating that, if you have to, you can come join me in the defense of Richmond, but I'd much prefer that you go on the offensive. Robert E. Lee, who's sometimes considered, you know, just focusing on the Army of Northern Virginia, knew quite well the value of the operations in the Shenandoah Valley, and he hoped for a repeat of the success that he had achieved there in 1862 under Jackson and 63 under Ewell. But Breckinridge, you know, demurs and goes and assists in the defense of Richmond. Strips the valley of all Confederate defenses. Now, this is where Ulysses S. Grant, he was a bulldog on the battlefield and he was a bulldog in the bigger picture. He has Sigel replaced right away, and 3 weeks to the day from Newmarket, Union forces under Hunter win the Battle of Piedmont on June 5th, killing the Confederate commander of all these forces that had been pulled way up from East Tennessee into deep southwest Virginia. They'll lose over 1,500 men in the commander, Grumble Jones. Hunter will hook up with Crook at Stanton, and this force of about 16,000 Federals will move on Lynchburg, the vitals of the Confederacy. If you look at a map of Virginia, the Orange and Alexandria Railroad comes south out of Charlottesville to Lynchburg. The Virginia and Tennessee Railroad comes up from East Tennessee and southwest Virginia to Lynchburg, where they meet the Southside Railroad, which carries all those supplies into Petersburg, supplying the Army of Northern Virginia and Lee in its defense of Richmond and Petersburg. Now, Robert E. Lee is so desperate to hold on to Lynchburg, because if he loses Lynchburg, odds are he probably cannot logistically hold on to Virginia much longer. So he's so desperate that at days before Grant begins his movement across the James River and begins the attacks on Petersburg, he detaches 20% of his effective infantry force under Jubal Early, who saves Lynchburg from capture. Now, Lee has also given him contingency orders, and he recognizes this very famous statement about Lee is that if it becomes a matter of siege, that we will lose in the end. And so he recognizes that he has to take action to pull off some of the pressure that Grant would soon be throwing at him. And so the plan was there for Early to launch a diversionary campaign down the Shenandoah Valley across the Potomac River, defeats Lew Wallace at Monocacy, and marches to the gates of Washington. He didn't capture Washington, but as they, as he wrote later, he said they scared the hell out of old Abe Lincoln. Well, not only did they scare the hell out of old Abe Lincoln, but this campaign diverted 24,000 soldiers from the siege of Petersburg. The 6th Corps was diverted northward. The 19th Corps, which had been with Banks in the early spring, was arriving on boats down in Petersburg at about the same time. And instead of getting off the boats, those boats were diverted up to Washington, D.C., robbing Grant of 2 corps for his operations at Petersburg at the beginning of July. So Early falls back into the Shenandoah Valley, wins a defensive victory at the Battle of Snicker's Gap on July 18th, and goes back to the old haunts at Fisher's Hill, where his army would rest and regroup for a few days. The Union commander of the pursuing forces, Major General Horatio Wright, him and George Crook, the senior combat officer in the Department of West Virginia now, Hunter, who has been kind of stashed aside after his failed Lynchburg campaign to a desk job as strictly the departmental commander. The two out in the field decide that Early was in full retreat on Richmond. And so Wright is going to take the 6th Corps and the 19th Corps troops that were with them and head back to Washington on July 20th. Well, Jubal Early had additional orders that came on the 22nd from Robert E. Lee guiding him. And it said, if you want to stay out there in the Shenandoah Valley, that's fine by me. The one requirement I have is that all those troops that you pulled away from here, your operations better make sure that they stay there and don't end up back down at Richmond before you can get here. So on July 23rd, he conducts a cavalry reconnaissance. He learns that the federal reinforcements have headed back to Washington. He attacks on the 24th at 2nd Kernstown, routs the federal force there under George Crook, one of the most embarrassing defeats the Federals ever suffered in the Shenandoah Valley throughout the entire war. And embarrassing defeats for Federals in the Valley of Humiliation is really saying a lot, because there were a number of them. One Federal officer wrote in his journal at the end of July that year, and he's summing up what had happened this year. He says, yeah, it was July in the Shenandoah Valley, and it was basically time for our annual butt-whooping out here by the Confederates. If you look, in 1861, lack of activity allowed Johnston to take his forces to First Manassas and turn the tide of battle there. So it had been a sore spot every year in Union operations. But Grant is on the heels of this defeat now. One of the game changers is Early, because Hunter had been burning homes of civilians in the Shenandoah Valley. He's going to send a force of cavalry to raid Chambersburg, and they will burn Chambersburg to the ground on July 30th. Next day, I believe, or is that the same day as the Battle of the Crater? So the backdrop against all this, and I said, Abraham Lincoln is the president running for re-election on the platform, basically, of stay the course, we're winning this war. But if you are a voter in the northern states and you're looking at all these casualties that have come out of the Overland campaign and the first section of the Petersburg campaign and the headlines of Chambersburg being burned, a Confederate army at the doorstep of Washington, D.C., it does not look very promising. Abraham Lincoln is so convinced he is not going to win re-election that on August 23rd, he writes a blind memorandum that basically states that it looks like I'm not going to be re-elected, but it's going to be my job to win this war between the November election and the March inauguration of the new administration. And he folds that piece of paper up, and he only has the bottom available, the blank spot, where he has all of his cabinet members sign it. And his plan was, when he lost the election, he was going to bring this out to them and show them what they had promised and trusted him to sign back in August. You know, even William Sherman, you know, he kind of gets down the Atlanta environs of Atlanta fairly quickly, wins a couple of defensive victories. And then you start seeing some of the newspapers joking, where's Sherman? When's Atlanta going to fall? Did he get lost in the Georgia wilderness? And so militarily, it does not look like Lincoln is going to be reelected. So Grant there, he's already detached 24,000 men to deal with Early in the Shenandoah Valley. He's going to send two more divisions of cavalry and what will turn out by the end of the war to be the Union's finest combat leader, Major General Philip Henry Sheridan. At the time he receives this appointment, however, his appointment to this command is anything but inevitable. When we look at these things and we see the success he had as a commander during the Appomattox campaign and Shenandoah campaigns, it's like, oh, it was inevitable that Sheridan was the guy that was going to get this. But we look at him, and he had been a successful and a tough fighter as an infantry division commander for most of his career. But he only fought in four significant battles at the Army of the Cumberland. His role as the cavalry commander with the Army of the Potomac in 1864 is up and down. I'm sure most of you are familiar with some of the failings during the Overland Campaign. He has that high point of the Yellow Tavern raid that, you know, fails at the Trevilian Station raid. So when he gets that appointment, it wasn't like there had been the stellar track record of success. Now compare him to Jubal Early. Jubal Early starts the war off at the Battle of Bull Run as commander of a brigade of Confederate infantry that sweeps across Chin Ridge in the final Confederate counterattack, fights in the peninsula where he's wounded at Williamsburg. He becomes a stellar commander under Stonewall Jackson during the latter half of 1862. His brigade, when all appeared to be disaster at the Battle of Cedar Mountain, Mike Block can really tell you the story, how Early's brigade comes up and plays a key holding role there until the rest of the army comes up and deploys. And then you also have his role in helping to restore the line at the railroad cut at Second Manassas. He arises to division command on the battlefield in the midst of the Battle of Antietam, where he helped Stonewall Jackson fashion that defense that held off immense numbers of Federals in the West Woods that bloody September in western Maryland. He would once again be restoring Stonewall Jackson's broken lines at the Battle of Fredericksburg, where he's out in the rear of the second line when Meade's Pennsylvania reserves break through. That's Jubal Early sweeping through. He holds Maryland Heights while the rest of the army is doing the fighting at the Battle of Chancellorsville in 1863. First day at Gettysburg, his division would crash into the Federals' flank and break open the fighting north of town there. Comes under a cloud of controversy, more of the, you know, lost cause. Could they have taken the hill that day? But nonetheless, we could go on. In the wilderness, he performed stellarly as a division commander. At Spotsylvania, he's commanding the 3rd Corps, does a splendid job there. So much so that Meade is dissatisfied with Dick Ewell, who puts him on sick leave and temporarily assigns Early to command of the 2nd Corps. Just before Early leaves to take them out to Lynchburg, Ewell tries to come back out and take command, and basically Lee tells him, "Nah, you're not well enough yet," and he would never be returned to command, and Early would be off and running with his Valley campaign. So you can just see the experience that Jubal Early has as a battlefield commander. And translate that over to is that his men in his army, even though it was smaller, he would have about 15,000 men to about 40,000 men of Sheridan. Sheridan did not have the qualitative veterans like Early did from the Army of Northern Virginia. Even the most veteran troops that Sheridan had, the 6th Army Corps, numbered 24,000 men when it marched into the wilderness on the 4th day of May in 1864. By the time the Battle of Monocacy was over, over half those men had been killed or wounded or were in a southern prison camp. Thousands more of those men's enlistments had expired, so that the 6th Corps that Sheridan has in the valley is but a fragment of that veteran formation that went into the Overland Campaign in the spring of 1864. George Crook's Little Army of West Virginia had, prior to the 1864 campaign, had several excellent combat regiments, but by and large it was composed of significantly combat inexperienced troops that had little shared history and had spent most of the war chasing down rebel raiders in Western Virginia and Western Maryland along the B&O Railroad, as opposed to being an open field combat command. Early, again, most of his men in his army were veterans from the Army of Northern Virginia in that campaign. So Sheridan, when he first comes out here, he meets with Lincoln and Grant and Halleck, and you know, gets the commands. And there's a lot of the commands famous about put yourself south of the enemy and stuff. And it all sounds great, but that was never really a practical plan or for implementation out here in the valley based on Confederate actions. And after Sheridan has met with Grant and Halleck, he gets called aside by Secretary of War Stanton. Stanton lets him know about the political consequences out here. And really, Sheridan's first job is to, remember, this is a week after Chambersburg has been burned. This is less than a month after Early showed up at Washington. His first job is to prevent these embarrassing raids and things and put a stop to that. So they would attempt to get south of his army, march out of Harper's Ferry on 7th or 8th of August, but Early would quickly get wind of that and head south down the Valley Turnpike to Fisher's Hill. The two armies would be facing off there in the middle of August. At this point, Sheridan's, all of his forces are not quite up and available, and he has something about 25,000 combat troops compared to Early's 15,000 at this point. He gets a message from Lieutenant General Grant warning him that two divisions were on their way from the Army of Northern Virginia to join Jubal Early. And so right away, Sheridan is going to send two brigades of cavalry under two of his finest cavalrymen, General Wesley Merritt and George Armstrong Custer. He's going to send them over to Guard Hill. This is a lovely battlefield today. I'm sure you've all been there when you drive over Interstate 66 for the Front Royal, exit number 6 out there. That's pretty much the heart of this battlefield. And Sheridan's warning from Grant is, Early's going to be much too large from you. In fact, Early and Anderson combined would have maybe 21,000 men or so. Sheridan still has a slight advantage. But they were miscalculating, and Grant was saying he's got about 40,000 men. You've got to back off. And from that moment on, Sheridan's strategy in the Shenandoah Valley becomes one of watching and waiting for Early to send some of these reinforcements back to Robert E. Lee, so that he could strike it when he was sure that he had the advantage of numbers in his favor. When Anderson first shows up north of Front Royal, Custer and Merritt give his advance guard under William Wofford and Fitz Lee's cavalry a black eye at the Battle of Guard Hill on August 16th. Sheridan falls back, a crafty retreat, back towards Harper's Ferry by the 23rd of August. The War Department was so concerned about the Shenandoah Valley events that this courier, Colonel Nicholas Chipman, who had carried Grant's message out to Sheridan, had been given orders to stay out there and watch and tell the report back to the War Department what Sheridan's doing, what's going on up there. Well, after about a week of being out there, this officer reports back to the War Department that the troops are in fine spirits, that the withdrawal has been magnificently handled, and that the men have a lot of confidence in the way it was carried out, fighting as they're falling back. Every day, Sheridan's launching reconnaissances in force from his cavalry or his infantry against Jubal Early. Early is going to have trouble. Early is not going to be cooperating with Anderson out there. On August 21st, as Sheridan's falling back toward Harper's Ferry and Charlestown, they're trying to have a combined offensive with Early heading west from east from the Martinsburg Bunker Hill area, and Anderson coming up from Winchester through Summit Point. And you know, Anderson he'll drive back some cavalry, and he'll go into camp around Summit Point at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and leave Early to fight, or you know, do the preliminary fighting that would just fizzle out and no battle would occur there. And the next day, Anderson would come up and join him at Charlestown. And a day later, Early's going to march off toward Shepherdstown into a meeting engagement with the Union cavalry. And you're going to see this repeatedly on several occasions where the two men get together and do not cooperate. At one point, Anderson realizes that he's up at Charlestown against Sheridan, who's got over 30,000 men in the lines just outside of Harper's Ferry, and Anderson's only got about 5,000 men up there. There is an opportunity that Sheridan missed to pounce out and just annihilate Anderson's small force while Early was like 12 miles away and not in supporting distance. Sheridan would miss another opportunity like that on September 3rd after the Battle of Berryville. But after that Berryville engagement, the next day on the 4th, Early would come over there to help out Anderson, but then he'd pull back and leave. And, you know, Anderson would go to Winchester, Early would go back towards Bunker Hill, and there was no cooperation. Finally, now keep in mind, against the backdrop of all of this, in the latter part of August, Sheridan's going to move closer towards Opequan Creek out into Clark County, Virginia. And basically, the east bank of that creek is going to be Union territory, and the west bank is Confederate territory. And every day, at some point there, or along the Valley Turnpike, where Union cavalry is going to advance southward under William Averill out of Martinsburg, they're going to be attacking the Confederate cavalry, driving it back, forcing Early to deploy infantry to restore his lines. This is happening every day. It's going to lull the Confederates into a false sense of security. Now, Sheridan at this time is going to show his kind of lack of, I wouldn't just say, he's got the political sense down, but he doesn't have all of the details there. And one detail that he overlooks in a major factor is the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. On about the 12th of September, he writes a descriptive communique back to Grant, informing him of the status, telling him how, hey, if there's no way Early can move north from where I'm at, I'll jump on him as soon as he tries and cut off his line of retreat back to the valley if he attempts to get up towards the Potomac River again, and that there's, hey, we're continuing with this plan to wait for Early to send back some of those reinforcements, and then we're going to hit him. But he closes this communique with a rather disturbing thought. And his last line is, he says, there's no entity hurting out here save the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. And, you know, as the President Garrett of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad had a close relationship with the Lincoln administration, they were already getting, you know, from all the destruction that Early had reaped upon that railroad in July and early August, the shipments of coal and supplies into Washington, D.C. for the coming winter were way behind schedule. And a lot of people, a lot of entities there were putting pressure on the Lincoln administration. We got to secure this line. We got to get Early away so that we know he's not going to come back up there and wreck it again. So my conclusion, that's one of the major main reasons why 4 days later on September 16th, Ulysses S. Grant is going to show up out in Charlestown to meet with Sheridan. Now, in the meantime, Jubal Early is going to send back Anderson and the infantry division under Joseph Kershaw on the 15th of September. Sheridan's going to get wind of this through his excellent network of scouts and spies in Winchester, in this case being the Quaker school teacher, Rebecca Wright. And he will learn that through the loose lips of a Louisiana officer at a kind of a get-together of young single people in Winchester one evening, and this wounded Louisiana officer was telling the girls, our force is really, really small. One of the things Early had been doing, it's the foot cavalry. They're moving around, and they tend to be, wherever that cavalry goes, that foot cavalry's reacting and showing up, and so it's an illusion, keeping up an illusion there. But when he starts telling this girl the army's the size of the army and that they were losing Kershaw, she reports back to Sheridan that the army is much smaller than is represented and that Kershaw is leaving the valley. So with that information, Sheridan comes up with a plan that he's going to sweep south of Winchester and come up and attack Early, cut him off, and attack northward. That's the plan he's going to take to Sheridan at Charlestown on September 16th. And Sheridan, Grant is going to break those orders, and he's going to say it was the easiest orders he ever gave. He simply told him to go in. The irony of that in Grant's memoirs is that that's not the battle plan that Sheridan implemented. Sheridan is going to change that battle plan because of Jubal Early's actions in the Shenandoah Valley. You see, Jubal Early, filters down probably to the lowest private in his army. Think of all the successes over the first 3 years of the war in the valley, and they see Sheridan with this immense army, don't understand that the political lease that he's been on, but at the beginning of September, you know, we had the fall of Atlanta, That's going to ease things up there. You're going to see operations start to pick, tempo of operations pick up a little bit at that point. And, but he, they Early writes in his memoirs, he said, I became convinced that the general opposite of me was totally without capacity. One Georgian lieutenant writing home to his family says, we'll soon have this army on the run like we did Milroy, Banks, Crooks, and Siegel, and all the others that came before it. They had that elan, that confidence in themselves. But so Early, you know, at a time when he sends over 3,000 men away and a battalion of artillery away from the valley, when he should have started being a little bit more cautious, he becomes more reckless than ever. His senior division commander, Major General Robert Rhodes, even warns him as he's going to take two of his largest divisions northward on the 18th to Martinsburg, Virginia, in an attempt to raid the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. He tells him, you're stringing this army out like a bunch of glass beads on a string, pulling it tighter and tighter. And sooner or later, if somebody hits anywhere along that, all those beads are going to break apart and go fly. Well, Early didn't listen. He goes on this raid, and Sheridan gets wind of it from some of his cavalry reports, and he changes his plan. Because now, knowing that half of Early's army is up in the area of Bunker Hill, one division at Bunker Hill, another all the way at Martinsburg, he decides he's going to send two divisions of cavalry to try and cut them off, and the main army is going to march directly east toward west toward Winchester out of Berryville, in, you know, where it would then turn northward from there. Well, a traffic jam on the morning of September 19th, where the crossing of Opequon Creek took place, where the commander of the 6th Army Corps, who had been placed in command of all infantry in the Army of the Shenandoah that day, in spite of orders to leave all baggage trains to the rear, the 19th Corps arrives at the creek first. The cavalry under James Wilson has secured the bridgehead at the western end of the Berryville Ravine. And he orders the General Emery, says, have your men march off the off the road and let the 6th Corps through. 6th Corps' orders were to lead the way. No problem with that. However, after the 6th Corps is ready, their wagon trains start rolling right across and back up well into there. That's going to delay the deployment of Sheridan's infantry by several hours that morning. And that is going to allow Jubal Early to get his forces by a forced march that night. Rhodes' division will make it up to the vicinity of just north of Stevenson's Depot late at night on the 18th, and Gordon would make it to Bunker Hill, and he would arrive on the battlefield just as the combat was about to start. Now, Jubal Early writes in his memoirs, he said, but I got word from when we were in Martinsburg that Sheridan and Grant had met in Harper's Ferry. And so he said, I knew there was going to be an attack. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I'll tell you what he did do or did not do. Major General Fitzhugh Lee, commander of the cavalry who had been at Winchester, he received no warning from Jubal Early that there was any pending immediate move. John B. Gordon received no such notice. John C. Breckinridge, his chief of staff, nephew of Senator Clay of Kentucky, Captain James Clay, wrote later on, he said, he knew that Breckinridge had no notice from Early that Sheridan would be attacking that day. In fact, that morning, before dawn, Breckinridge, who's up in the vicinity of Brucetown and Stevenson's Depot, guarding the crossings of the Opequon Creek in that region, had gone out to check his pickets, and he sent Captain Clay into Winchester because Breckinridge's wife had arrived the previous day. And he told her, he said, I'm going out to, he sent him back to tell his wife that he would be in for breakfast soon as he checked the picket lines. Well, George Custer shows up on the other side of the creek and attacks, and he never made it for that breakfast date. And so, as John B. Gordon wrote in his memoirs, Early was surprised. I think Jubal Early got the message that he knew, well, I better be getting back there. Something's going to be happening. But I don't think he realized that Sheridan's advance would be as instantaneous as what it was. On the battlefield, Sheridan's tactics there, he has this advantage of numbers. His initial attack, he's going to have three divisions numbering nearly 20,000 men attacking initially two Confederate divisions that numbered less than 6,000 men. They're going to be put to rout. Fortunately for the Confederates, there's a gap developing in the middle of the Union line as it gets to its height of success. And into that gap, three brigades under the command of Major General Robert Rodes attack and collapse the flanks of both the 6th Corps and the 19th Corps and send them reeling back. Now, a lot of Confederate famous what-ifs about the Battle of 3rd Winchester involve that if only Warden had been available at that time, they could have driven them all the way back up the Berryville Ravine to Opequon Creek and destroyed Sheridan's army. Well, the truth of the matter is, in reserve that morning, Sheridan had more infantry in reserve with David Russell's 6th Corps Division and William Dwight's 19th Corps Division, 9,000 men, than Early had in his entire army effectives on that day. That is a highly unlikely thing. Plus, he had massive deployments of artillery behind his infantry. So that is kind of not a realistic scenario there. But be that as it may, they do stop Sheridan's advance cold. David Russell would be killed, restoring the line behind the 6th Corps. The 19th Corps would have significant hard fighting on the right flank, but it would hold. Sheridan would ride up to the right flank where the 19th Army Corps has taken quite a beating, losing over 2,000 men in that initial attack out there. And the commander of the 19th Corps, General William Emery, was rather disheartened by what had occurred, and he felt that, you know, that he rather assumed that it was going to be a time to cover the retreat and head back and start over again. And Sheridan rides up there, and he looks at him, and he says, and Emory's like, "My God, my dead are everywhere." And Sheridan's like, "Man, you haven't begun to fight yet. I've got George Crook coming up with 10,000 men, and we're going to whip those fellows as they haven't been whipped yet." And when George Crook comes up, he's going to survey the landscape, and he's going to decide he's not too sure about these shaky 19th Corps guys. They've taken quite a beating. And he felt that if the Confederates pushed hard one more time, that they might those troops would retreat and potentially carry Crook's away with it. So he takes half his forces over to the north side of a swampy stream by the name of Redbud Run, and they will begin the final attack. They will flank Early's line. His infantry will begin to retreat. There's going to be a lot of hard fighting, but this is the beginning of the end. Early here is up there, and he's kind of played all of his cards. He's ordered Breckinridge back to the battlefield. Breckinridge is coming back to the battlefield, so closely pressed by the Union cavalry under Wesley Merritt that he has to leave George S. Patton's brigade behind and return to the main battlefield with only two brigades of infantry. And Patton would kind of get caught up in a dangerous situation there around the Hackwood Mansion. And so as this whole thing is coming up, you're going to have another division of cavalry farther to the west under General William Woods Averill kind of sweeping down, driving back a small force of Confederate cavalry west of the Valley Turnpike. And all of that cavalry sweeping in behind the Confederate line is right about the same time that George Crook is smashed and begin to drive back the Confederate infantry force. So that cavalry would charge into the rear. And Early in Breckinridge would order Breckinridge's forces, which had just arrived there in the line of battle, they would turn, and they would like facing like me to you, but they were behind the main Confederate line, then engaged with the 6th Corps and the Army of West Virginia. They would literally turn around and advance in this direction and open fire and attack the Union cavalry that had gotten in their rear. They will be successful, and Custer and Averill, they'll all have to fall back about 1,000 yards back up the pike and regroup. At this point, some of the Union cavalry had actually ventured into the outskirts of the town of Winchester, and a lot of the rear guard troops, they had to scramble to get stragglers and wagon guards together to open fire and drive those men back out of the town. Now, all of that firing, you have the main Confederate forces under Rodes, Gordon, and Ramseur, and Rodes, by the way, had been killed during his initial counterattack, and its division's now under the command of General Battle. their men are going to get shaky because they hear all this firing behind them. Even though Warden had temporarily cleared out that cavalry, that begins to add to the confusion. So that Confederate line falls back. It's going to fall back a couple of times until it gets into a last stand around Winchester where it's holding out. And the Union cavalry would arrive back on the scene and sweep around the left flank of that infantry and send what was left of his army whirling through Winchester. Jubal Early's saving grace here was the fact that operating on the left flank of the Union cavalry was a rather docile Union cavalry commander by the name of James Harrison Wilson. He has 3,000 splendidly armed cavalrymen, all have the Spencer repeating rifles and carbines. And every one of them, it's probably the first time that an entire division in the United States Army carried repeating rifles into battle. But yet, he's not going to press the attack on the southern end of the battlefield the way that Merritt and Custer did on the northern end of the battlefield. And as a result, Early's going to be able to withdraw 800 men under the command of Colonel Thomas Munford, put them on the heights behind Winchester, where old Fort Milroy was and Fort Jackson from 1861, eject the advance of the Union cavalry, and hold them off. Basically, he's going to hold the back door shut while Jubal Early's infantry and artillery are going to stream in confusion through the town of Winchester. Early is routed. As one of the veterans of the Sixth Corps, an Army of the Potomac officer who had been through 3 years, and just think about the Army of the Potomac experience. They had never seen anything like this. This officer writes, I can't remember if it was a letter or his journal, he writes home and he says, "They are whipped. Yes, for once in their life they have been whipped, literally skinned alive." Soldiers of the Vermont Brigade, which long ago, after George McClellan had been relieved of command of the Army of the Potomac, and they were just totally frustrated with all the seeming incompetence in the command structure that they dealt with, they had made a pledge, they're never going to cheer any more generals. They ended that pledge when Phil Sheridan rode along their battle line at the very end of the Third Battle of Winchester. Phil Sheridan, during that counterattack, had been like a ball of lightning. When Crook first went in, you know, he's riding south. Emory Upton's already got his division going in. And as Sheridan gets closer down towards the Berryville Turnpike, the rest of the Sixth Corps isn't as speedy in getting into action. And as he's riding along the battlefield, one brigade of Pennsylvanians is coming out of some woods into an opening, and it's coming under heavy artillery fire from the Confederates and some redoubts outside of Winchester. And the men start falling into confusion, and the colonel writes, "But then General Sheridan appeared on the scene and cheered the men and restored the line." Better description of that comes from a sergeant of the 49th Pennsylvania Infantry. He wrote, he said, "Yeah, just when it seemed like we might fall back again, General Sheridan and rides up amongst the men and yells out, 'Boys, the only way to do this is to kill every rebel son of a bitch out there.' And the men start cheering and get back into it." And then to close out his little commentary and his letter home to his wife, that Pennsylvania soldier writes, "And he was smiling the whole time." So the men are picking up this electricity there. He rides down. At this point, he goes out between the skirmish line and the battle line of the Sixth Corps elements down along Route 7 or the Berryville Turnpike, and they're really not advancing at this point. He rides back to the rear, and he sees General Getty, the commander of the division on the left flank of the Sixth Corps, and he tells them, "Press them, General." And then he cusses out a blue streak that he was famous for during battle. And then he looks at him again with a ball of fire in his eyes and says, "Press them, General. I know they'll run." And, you know, he's also rides up to some other officers, some Ohio troops, and he says, "Come on, boys, go forward and give them hell." He says, "Torbert's on the right flank, and he's giving it to him over there. Crook's in the center giving him hell. Now I want you guys to give it to him right here." And this whole, that's the way these men were inspired. To us, the most famous ride of Sheridan is that ride he made on the morning, the Battle of Cedar Creek, 30 days after this. But I think that really, perhaps the more important ride that elicited the response that morning was when these soldiers of all these corps, because the 19th men were coming up behind this and noticing Sheridan's actions, but They knew that this man had been in the thickest of the fight, riding around, encouraging the men on the front lines of battle. So 30 days later, when he's riding amongst the retreating elements and encouraging them to go back to the front, using that salty, spicy language that he learned from the Teamsters back in his hometown of Somerset, Ohio, they reacted. Because Sheridan and his army, on September 19, 1864, at the Battle of Opequon Creek, gained an elan that the Army of the Potomac elements had never previously known. And what they had gained, they had taken from Jubal Early and the Second Corps of the Army of Northern Virginia. The tables had been turned in the Shenandoah Valley in irrevocable fashion. It cost Sheridan 5,000 men killed, wounded, and a few captured. Jubal Early, though, had suffered devastating losses. Several brigade commanders were killed or wounded seriously and gone for the rest of the war. Most notable loss was obviously the death of General Robert Rhodes, who it seems to, once he's gone, there's that calming influence that he seems to have exercised by his presence that would no longer be there. One thing you can't underestimate here is not just the loss of these high-ranking officers, but there were men, you think of all the losses that the Army of the Northern Virginia suffered during the Overland Campaign, all the colonels and people. During the summer, during July and August, and there's fighting going on, but you didn't have any major battles. There were a lot of men who had been promoted up into colonels, majors, and new lieutenant colonels and captains that had opportunities to learn their new roles in kind of a low-intensity combat situation. They would not have that anymore. They would be gone. There was nobody really with any experience at all to call upon. And this would have direct ramifications in Jubal Early's loss of control over troops at the Battle of Cedar Creek, which is a whole other story there. I'll just say this. Those troops fought for about 5 hours, from about 5:30 in the morning till 10:30 in the morning there, before they ran out of gas in attacking Sheridan's army. And I would challenge you to compare that to the fighting at some of the other battles. And you know, what did Longstreet call his fighting on the second, the best 3 hours of combat of the war? These guys went for 5 hours that morning. But that's a whole other story. But what point I want to make is that these losses in officers and all the NCOs that are lost, again, a third of his army will be lost. 3 days later, Sheridan, they say, he was slow in following him up. Well, okay. 3 days later, he wipes him out again at the Battle of Fisher's Hill and captures 1,200 more prisoners, about 15 pieces of artillery. So Early's lost about half his artillery between these two battles, over 5,000 men. His army's devastated at this point. And he will make his best effort to retrieve the day at the Battle of Cedar Creek, but unfortunately, the confidence that had grown into the men of Sheridan's army in both themselves and their commanders, and the losses that the Army of the Valley District under Early had incurred by that point had rendered their efforts fruitless. Abraham Lincoln was probably the most grateful man when he got the news late on September 19th or August or July 20th about the victory at Third Winchester. He writes back a dispatch saying, "God bless you all, officers and men strongly inclined to come up and visit you." I suspect with the thought of the president passing through Mosby's Confederacy that somebody back at the War Department said, "Mr. President, your telegram will suffice." You know, it's at that point, you know, the Third Battle of Winchester, you know, there's a lot made about the Atlanta campaign. Well, there's more men killed and wounded in this battle than all but one battle of the Atlanta campaign, the actual Battle of Atlanta on July 22nd. It's much more deadlier combat out here. If you know, Kenesaw Mountain, about 3,000-4,000 men, have 9,000 combined casualties at the Third Battle of Winchester. I mean, it's a bigger battle than First Manassas out there. So it's tremendous. Ulysses S. Grant, you know, she's going to urge Sheridan to go on. He wants Sheridan to take that campaign east of the Blue Ridge, go at Lynchburg, go at Gordonsville. But I think Sheridan, he's got a number of men in his army who had been with Hunter, and he's achieved unprecedented success. You know, you just look at what he's achieved here at this point, and he gets down in that Port Republic area. Kershaw reinforces early, and that's when he decides, oh, we're going to do this burning thing, clear out the valley and head back north and start sending troops back to Grant. I think that in the spring of 1865, when Sheridan, although it wasn't in his orders, he suddenly appears at Petersburg to get in on the kill, I think he realized he had a lot of time to think about it, and especially after the Battle of Cedar Creek, where they started seeing the poor condition that the Confederacy had devolved into after the battles of Fisher's Hill, and in terms of horses and supplies and just how badly set they were. I think at that point he started to realize, wow, I think I might have had an opportunity to have potentially ended this thing in the fall of 1864. And so I think that's kind of sitting in Sheridan's mind over those several months between the Battle of Cedar Creek and Waynesboro and his advance over to join Grant in the Army of the Potomac for the final showdown with Lee. So, well, thank you all for having me out here again. We got some time for questions.
What time do you have for Q&A?
About 15 minutes.
Okay. We've got about 15 minutes for Q&A, if anybody would like to ask a question.
Okay, right here.
So what's Early really thinking about sending those troops back to Lee?
Back to Lee?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, what is Early thinking about sending troops back to Lee? First thing we have to understand about Jubal Early is that Jubal Early is a better commander because he's serving under Lee, and he's so dedicated to Lee that he's putting Lee's needs ahead of his own. So there's really nothing wrong with sending those troops back to Lee. But we've got to then start thinking like a Stonewall Jackson. There's no sense in Jubal Early attempting to hold territory in the Shenandoah Valley. The Confederacy's hopes really are political, you know, war weariness in the North, having the Northern people say, enough, bring our boys home and let's let them go their merry way. I don't think he quite got that, and he wanted to stay up there and be more belligerent. Whereas if we look at Stonewall Jackson, the pinnacle of his success after the First Battle of Winchester in 1862, he's headed up towards Harper's Ferry. He's got McDowell's corps coming over the Blue Ridge from the east. Fremont's got a corps coming in from the west. Does he go and try and go toe to? No. He falls back down, uses the terrain and topography of the valley to divide up the Union forces and deals with them one at a time down there in that region. So not saying that Early could have done it, but there was definitely better tactics that he could have utilized.
Early didn't appreciate the advantage of Native? He's not really a native of that.
No,
and Jackson was.
Yeah, and the other misconception, because he was not with Jackson in 1862. And the other thing is, all that's left really of Jackson's army is William Terry's brigade of about 800 men going into 3rd Winchester. This is more the 2nd Corps, Dick Ewell's 2nd Corps there. Question back in the back?
Yeah, was Dwight's division brought out of reserve during the flank attack?
Well, yes, Dwight's division is in column of regiments coming through a thick wooded, and you know it's marching one regiment behind the other. In the front of that column, it gets to the it's coming up very slowly. It's taking artillery fire into its flank. Gordon's men in Alabama Brigade are driving Grover's troops back on it. It's got all these fugitives coming. And Emory's in a panic. He rides up to General Dwight, and he says, have this thing stopped at once, and goes and turns to the lead regiment, 114th New York. It's going to be 10, 15 minutes before the next regiment's going to be able to join, but they send them out there. These New Yorkers, 350 men, are going to go into the teeth of the Colin Battle's Alabama Brigade and stop them cold. They're going to lose 185 men out of the 350 that they take into battle, but they're going to buy enough time for the rest of their brigade to come up and deploy behind a fence out in a field there right near Redbud Run. And that position, they'll be driven back and from that fence line back into the woods, and there'll be some fluid combat there. But for the most part, Dwight's men hold that line until Crook comes up.
What is it that he wrote after the fight that got him arrested?
Dwight, the truth.
That'll always get you in trouble.
You have to understand that. General Emery, okay, Dwight was not the West Pointer. General Emery was a West Pointer, and the commander of the 8,000-man 2nd Division, which had gone into that and launched that headlong, successful charge, but came back and was just totally routed and panicked. They could not stop it. The men went to the rear, and it was just utter chaos and pandemonium. But it was considered improper for the commander, like Dwight, to describe what was going on with the other division. And even though, as Dwight pointed out, well, I was trying to deploy my division in the middle of all of this. And you can read in Dwight's report then see where he takes with relish and stuff, pointing out there's all these men and he's rallying men and there were no officers from Grover's division to be found and things like that. And so he took shots at Emery's favorite. But I'll say this, in the middle of the battle, when Sheridan gets back there, one of the first thing that he does is he restores Dwight to command of his division in the middle of the Battle of Cedar Creek. So there's another question over here. Yes, sir.
The Confederates had posted some guns north of Red Bud Creek under Breathitt.
Yes.
And they had sharpshooters up there.
Yes, the dismounted cavalrymen.
I'm going to make an analogy. In the Port Republic battle, Jackson noted that something called the colon, and they had artillery on top of there, and he said that needs to be taken. Now, switching over to 3rd Winchester, the Union troops suffered terribly from the flanking fire from those guns and the sharpshooters all day. There were only 2 attempts. My question is, one was brushed off in the morning, and the other one was Crook's attack, which ultimately pushed through. Why didn't the Union, what was wrong with the Union that they didn't get the memo about that to go and get those guys out of there much earlier in the battle and save themselves all these
guys? Well, first of all, you generally go into battle like that and you have cavalry screening both of your flanks. Sheridan took all of Wilson's division and wanted to use it as shock troops on the southern end of the battlefield to cut off the retreat to the south, once Early's men. He had no cavalry over there in screening function, so he's got limited. His decision there in his first battle as a commander allowed that to happen. He didn't have the cavalry there. Perhaps, I don't think a brigade of cavalry is going to drive them off, but they're going to know that it's there. They're not going to realize it once they're charging out of the woods and into the field there, so they'll realize that it's there. That's John.
Yeah, I was just thinking about James Wilson's performance in the Calps Wilson raid, and also here at 3rd Winchester. How instrumental was Sheridan getting him moved to the west? He wanted to get rid of it, didn't he?
Oh, well, so John's question is, how instrumental was Sheridan in getting rid of James Wilson? Well, Wilson does a poor job from the beginning and during the Battle of the Wilderness under Sheridan, although I have to say some of the blame there should rest with Meade, because he takes the weakest cavalry division of the three and puts it closest to where the Army of Northern Virginia is going to be coming from. But so there's never been the greatest relationship there with Wilson. Wilson, by all accounts, from everybody, Grant, and he was Grant's boy.
The library will close in 30 minutes at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
If you need to make arrangements for a ride home, please.
They haven't updated that announcement recently.
If you need to apply for a library card,
it's like when you were here.
It's a recording, right?
It's the same person.
But he did poorly on the
couch. Yeah, and he's kept around, and Sheridan keeps his mouth shut. Why? Who was Wilson's mentor? Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he deals with him. And when he gets a telegraph, like I think on the 25th or 26th of September, he said, I need you to send me a good cavalryman for Sherman. And he's like, I got just the guy for you. Because he had just gotten rid of William Woods Averell. Averell, who is generally attributed to Fisher's Hill being relieved of command. But I uncovered a piece of evidence from one of Averell's brigadier generals. Averell starts running afoul of Sheridan during the Third Battle of Winchester. He was fine when he was an independent commander. I liked the guy as an independent commander, whether it's, you know, the raids in West Virginia, the Battle of Moorefield, the Battle of Rutherford's Farm, and when he's operating up on out of Martinsburg when he's not serving directly under Torbert. He's a happy camper doing his thing, raiding down the pike, falling back as you know, doing his job. But the minute he's given instructions and asked to serve as part of the cavalry corps, he goes back to Chancellorsville, Averell, where he just kind of, you know, moves slowly. In fact, in the midst of the Third Battle of Winchester, where he sends a staff officer into Sheridan and tells him they've been out fighting all week and their horses were rather tired, so they were having a slow time of it. Well, you know what? So had Custer's men, so had Merritt's men, so had Devon's men. They had all been out fighting all week for months. And Sheridan looks at that staff officer and says, I don't give a damn about horse flesh. You tell him I said charge. but if you look at the casualties of Averell, he's got about 40 men killed and wounded in his division at 3rd Winchester. Merritt, who's right next to him, 250 men killed and wounded. And, you know, it takes Merritt hours to come south from Martinsburg and from Bunker Hill to Stevenson's Depot against token resistance when Custer and his crowd had been fighting against Breckinridge's infantry there. Is that another? Was there someone else over here had a question for you?
Yes. Real quick. Grant's decision to send Sheridan west, was he sending Custer and Merritt west with Sheridan in command, or was he sending Sheridan? And since we're sending Sheridan, we better send Custer and Merritt.
First, it was recognized that because of that raid into Chambersburg, Pennsylvania,
right,
that, you know, Early's cavalry force, when it comes back from the Maryland raid, in first raid in July to Washington, it gets its, you know, there's some horses brought up from Southwest Virginia, plus those that were picked up over in Maryland. It's at its strongest right around the Second Battle of Kernstown, about 5,000 men. And so the cavalry in the valley was chaos. Averell and Dufier's division just were, you know, you've probably heard a lot of criticism of the, quote, Valley Cavalry under Early. Keep this in mind. They generally did a pretty good job when they were up against Averell and Dufier. So it was like, you know, we've heard the term JV thrown out a lot here, but literally, you kind of had some, they were the JV forces, and where they really, they get surprised by Averell at Moorefield, and they're going to lose 700 men right there. By 3rd Winchester, that division that had been 5,000 men at the end of July is down to 3,000. And so it's there. But it was thought that because of that cavalry raid that they needed more and more competent cavalry out there. And it becomes the decisive factor. In fact, one of the things, all those cavalry raids every day at the outset of the fighting at Winchester, when Wilson's cavalry breaks through and is coming up the pike toward Winchester from Berryville, Stephen D. Ramseur, he's like, okay, standard business as usual. This is just the daily breakthrough. I'm going to launch a counterattack. Well, Fitz Lee said, well, let's wait and see what's what. This seems a bit more aggressive than what they're usually doing there. And so that's what I say. It's kind of Sheridan's strategy, not necessarily that he planned it out this way, but it turns out kind of having the effect of all these punching across the creek every day kind of lulls them into a false sense of security. And, you know, kind of like the boy that cried wolf when they really were coming, nobody was ready for it. You know, they're like, yeah.
One more question. You get your second one. Congratulations.
first time here, thank you. Question about teamwork on the battlefield. First of all, I enjoyed reading your book very much. I saw several examples of teamwork on the battlefield, say from the Union side, but also the Confederate. But let's talk about more specifically. There was an incident where a regiment, I forget which one, a unit is in trouble. Crook saw that. Thomas, under Emory, was being beckoned to come to that unit's aid to do an obvious flanking maneuver, save or bacon. He said no because Emory said to forbade that. And then you noted that McMillan, who's also under Emory, does turn around and come to the aid of that regiment. I'm wondering, why did Thomas hold back under Emory when McMillan, who's also under Emory, and said,
well, one of the things that happens is that And it's hard to say what happened there because, you know, it's one of those things, both Emory Upton and Crook, especially Emory Upton, was beside himself with the behavior of Thomas. But Thomas was, Emory, his corps commander, gave him an order because they charged in there without orders and then he's ordered to halt. And they were about out of ammunition in there. And McMillan's going to come up with another regiment, the 160th of New York, that had previously gone back up, replenished its ammunition. Now, accounts from the 160th New York indicate that they do go out at some point and get engaged. But we do know that Emory Upton took troops out and put them in front of the two regiments under Colonel Thomas and just literally marched out in front of them and opened a flank fire into that stone wall there. So it was just, you might say that was kind of par for the course, the types of things that you had seen in the Army of the Potomac throughout the war, lack of trust and things there. And I think Emory with the losses that his command had experienced there, again, 2,000 men in that opening attack, he had kind of lost it there a little bit, you know. So
now you know why he's called Mr. Shenandoah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Authorize him to put that on the website.
Sure.
The audio thing. Great job. Fantastic. Great seeing you.
Okay.
Thank you. Very nice. You're going to be in front.